Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Senate has passed its 2013 Farm Bill, a huge piece of legislation totaling nearly $1 trillion. On today's show, we find out just what's in the bill and why, as Michigan Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow likes to say, Michigan is written into its every page. And we get an update on the Detroit mayoral race after one of the front runners gets booted off the ballot. But first, we continue our look at the Great Lakes. Yesterday, we talked about the state's blue economy, using our water resources to create jobs and boost industry here in Michigan. So today, we turn to some encouraging news about the lakes from the Healing Our Waters Great Lakes Coalition. They've just released an interactive map pinpointing success stories across the region, efforts to restore the lakes with projects that are funded by the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Let's get an idea of what these success stories are and the challenges that still remain to the Great Lakes. For that, we turn to Andy Buxbaum, who's the director of the National Wildlife Federation's Regional Great Lakes Office. Thanks for joining us today, Andy.
Hi, Cindy. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here to talk about success stories. And I'm wondering if you could describe for us how these projects that have been funded by the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative have actually, you know, in a hands-on way, helped the Great Lakes.
Well, what we decided to do is we decided to feature 60 of the best success stories around the region, many of them in Michigan, that were funded by this Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. In the last 4 years, the federal government has put $1.3 billion into the Great Lakes region. And that helps our economy, of course, but it really helps the Great Lakes. And we wanted to illustrate that. And so we put together this map. We've got 60 different success stories there. They range from toxic waste cleanup to habitat to invasive species, stopping invasive species. And through that, we want people to see firsthand what the dollars are doing, because this is a phenomenal program, it's very popular, and we want to make sure that the funding stream continues.
Now, when you say that amount, that $1.3 billion, sometimes a problem is so huge that what sounds like a large amount of money is literally a drop in the bucket. But did you feel that that $1.3 billion was enough to really make a noticeable difference?
Yes, it is. $1.3 billion is a lot of money for anybody. I mean, $1 billion matters. It's not nearly enough, but it's much more than a drop in the bucket. What we're seeing is, I'll give you a few examples here. In Detroit, for example, we're seeing a Belle Isle restoration project where they're restoring the lagoon there, the Blue Heron Lagoon, which is going to allow flow in and out. It's going to allow fishing. It's going to be a project which helps Belle Isle get off its feet, which, of course, is ecologically wonderful, but even more important for the economic well-being of Detroit. Another project south of Detroit in the Elias Lagoon. It's Elias Cove. It used to be called the Black Lagoon because it was so toxic. And they've taken 95,000 cubic yards of toxic sediment out. Now, to give you some idea, a cubic yard is about a ton. So 95,000 tons of toxic sediment out, which had PCBs and mercury and lead. And now it's gone. And that habitat is being restored. And now it's a place that people can go to enjoy. And it's no longer a blight on Trenton. It's a place that attracts people.
And I know we talked with a wildlife expert who was celebrating the fact that beaver dams are starting to pop up along the Detroit River. So this is going hand in glove with what you're talking about.
Exactly. And so instead of being a negative, a blight that turns into a positive that draws people to the waterfront, we helped to sponsor a study by the Brookings Institution about 5 years ago. And we asked them, what is the economic return on investment to making these Great Lakes restoration investments? And they said that for every dollar invested in Great Lakes ecosystem restoration, cleaning up the Great Lakes, you get between $2 and $4 of economic returns. So if you invest $20 billion in Great Lakes restoration, which was the total price tag of the whole plan, you get up to $80 billion return. There's not many federal investments that pay that kind of return. And so this is an economic wise decision by Congress, and it's really important for the 30 million people who live here.
When we're talking about that return, where are those dollars coming from? When you say that we see that $80 billion in return, in what way? Taxes?
Well, you see it in jobs. There's so many industries dependent on the Great Lakes. And I'm not just talking about the green industry. I mean, certainly fishing, $4 billion. Boating, $2 billion. Tourism, $12 billion. Those are big numbers. But you know what? Auto companies, steel companies, they all require fresh, clean water. Water intensive industries are important here. And given the new technology industries that are locating here, including the new ways the auto companies are doing business, they need even more water. Technology requires clean water. So we are going to be a draw to industries from all over the world because of the technology that we'll need to locate here, because we're going to be one of the few places where we actually have fresh, clean water left.
I'm talking with Andy Buxbaum with the National Wildlife Federation's Regional Great Lakes Office, talking about success stories. But with that, you said it earlier that there's much to be done. What are your major concerns when you think about the to-do list for the Great Lakes?
Well, we've made a lot of progress in cleaning up toxic sediment, but there's a lot left to go. So, for example, in addition to the Detroit places that we've seen cleaned up in Muskegon, there's another huge cleanup that's been very successful in Muskegon Lake, 45,000 cubic yards. That is tons of toxic sediment. But there are many of those places left. And so we need to keep on cleaning up the toxic sediments around the lakes. We know that we're restoring 20,000 acres of wetlands so far. We need to make sure we're storing the right wetlands at the right places and in the right ways. But when you're talking about other threats, things that we haven't seen success in yet, of course there's Asian carp, there's invasive species. We've gotten a handle on some invasive species, but Asian carp remains a huge threat. And we need to take action to deal with that. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is helping, but there are obviously some other measures that we need. Mm-hmm. We need to get the Army Corps of Engineers to agree to put the barriers in the Chicago canals. There are other sources of carp in other places that we need to address as well. Another one, which we're seeing cropping up more and more in many places, are algal blooms, the big green mats of algae that are now floating. Well, certainly Lake Erie was the poster child for that 2 years ago, the worst in history. There were over 2,500 square miles of algae in Lake Erie. And it was a terrible record to have set. Last year, because it didn't rain as much and there wasn't as much runoff, there was hardly any. This year, they're expecting it some, hopefully not as bad as 2011. But it's a combination of more rainfall, warmer weather, and that rainfall carries in fertilizer runoff. And the fertilizer from farms is primarily the primary cause of that in Lake Erie. Now we're seeing other algal blooms in other places. Saginaw Bay has similar problems, similar causes. We're seeing it in Sleeping Bear Dunes.
Really?
Yes. You have native algae called Cladophora, and there the problem is a bit different. It's harder to fix. And Lake Erie, Saginaw Bay, we're working with the agriculture community to find ways of reducing runoff from fertilizer. Mm-hmm. In Sleeping Bear Dunes, we're getting these algal blooms from that are really caused by invasive species. Zebra mussels are clarifying the water to such an extent that you're getting sunlight and nutrients way down in the bottom. The cladophora is exploding. Round gobies are getting involved in eating it. And we're actually seeing naturally occurring botulism outbreaks in that algae that are killing birds and fish and, of course, threatening pets. And so this is Sleeping Bear Dunes. This is... Yeah. Was ranked the most beautiful place in the world.
Yes,
by one of the TV, mm-hmm. the national TV shows, mm-hmm. just last year. We can't afford to let this gem be degraded.
So the money for restoration and addressing problems in the Great Lakes is coming from the federal government, $1.36 billion during the first 4 years of the initiative. Here's a question: is the support there in Washington to maintain Great Lakes restoration funding?
This is one of those incredibly rare programs which is truly bipartisan. Last year, President Obama proposed $300 million for Great Lakes Restoration funding. I believe it might have been the only program in the country where the U.S. House and Senate supported and championed that dollar amount. And so he proposed $300 million, and $300 million passed. It was championed by Republicans. It was championed by Democrats. And there's a reason for that.
And why?
Well— The Great Lakes are these phenomenal wonders of the world. We recognize that, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're places we fish, we swim. Well, they're also drinking water for 30 million people. They're also the economic backbone of this region. There are 800,000 jobs in Michigan alone that are from industries that depend on the Great Lakes. $800,000. That's $30 billion a year in wages.
And then you factor in all the other Great Lakes states.
It's double that. But Michigan is Michigan is special. We're the Great Lakes state, right?
Yes,
so this really hits us. And so because of that, Great Lakes are they're more than an issue. They're more than a concern. They're actually our way of life, and they appeal across the board. It doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican or something else. They are crucial really to our identity as a region, to our economic prosperity, and also, of course, to our health, both ecological and our physical health.
Andy Buxbaum, the director of the National Wildlife Federation's Regional Great Lakes Office. Thanks for talking with us today.
Cindy, thanks so much.
Meanwhile, a three-day conference is getting underway today in Marquette, looking at the unique needs of cities on the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence River. More than 100 American and Canadian cities are part of the group organizing the conference. Dave Ulrich is the group's executive director. He says this year's conference is focusing on the effects of climate change on Great Lakes cities, especially on water levels in the lakes. Ulrich also expects invasive species, especially Asian carp, will be a major area of discussion at this conference. Still to come, we speak with Senator Debbie Stabenow about the 2013 Farm Bill. And we try to get a better understanding about what it means for those who receive federal food stamps. But before that, we'll go back, way back, to what Michigan looked like centuries ago. Just who were the first people to call Michigan home? That story's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. After nearly 3 days of digging in an overgrown field in Oakland County, the FBI has called off its latest search for the remains of Jimmy Hoffa. That search was launched after 85-year-old Anthony Zerilli claimed that Hoffa had been knocked over the head with a shovel and buried alive in the Oakland Township field. Since Zerilli is the son of the 60s reputed Detroit Mafia boss Joseph Zerilli, this claim was enough to trigger the search, a search that yielded nothing. Zerilli's attorney, however, maintains the FBI could have missed something because the court limited the feds to a small portion of the field. An FBI spokesman would not say whether the agency would dig again to search for the Teamsters boss who vanished from a Bloomfield restaurant in July of 1975. Michigan Radio's Jack Lessenberry has a theory about just where Jimmy Hoffa is. You can find my conversation with Jack online at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. It's official. One of the front runners in Detroit's mayor's race has bowed out, undone by a basic timing error. Mike Duggan announced he will not appeal a court ruling that tossed him off the primary ballot because he turned in campaign signatures 2 weeks before what would have been the one-year mark of his residency in Detroit. The city charter requires candidates to have lived in the city for a full year. Detroit Free Press editorial writer Nancy Cafford joins us now. Nancy, for all the talk about how Mike Duggan was going to be a good mayor of Detroit and all of his experience and working under Ed McNamara when he was the Wayne County executive, neither Mike Duggan nor his staff could figure out how to get on and stay on the ballot?
You know, I think that a lot of people, the Elections Commission, the city clerk, Mike Duggan, his attorneys, several other elections experts read the language in the charter at the time of filing, must have been a resident for 1 year at the time of filing, and thought that at the time of filing was sort of legalese for the filing deadline. Now, is not having thought of another interpretation of that. Should they have done that? Obviously, in retrospect, they should have thought of every possibility. You know, and if he were going to be in the race, we could ask, you know, as a guy who would overlook this, is, should this figure into the calculation of whether or not he could be mayor? But that's kind of a moot point now.
Well, there are a lot of people I've noticed on Facebook. The question kind of comes down, should anyone even lament this loss if they got this wrong?
That is something that I'm seeing people talk about, too. I think that his decision not to take this to the Supreme Court probably is the right choice for him because of that very sentiment that you're discussing, that politically the damage has been done, the narrative that he's a guy who just moved to Detroit to sort of foist himself into this onto this race would not be improved by getting the Supreme Court to place his name on the ballot, assuming he could even get a favorable ruling from the court. But, you know, the big question that I think that we need to also be talking about is Michigan election law has always tilted toward access to the ballot. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, for a long time we had the ruling that substantial compliance was the, kind of enough, and that what we really needed to do was be sort of leaning in the favor of putting measures or candidates or whatever before voters and letting voters be the ones to decide whether or not they, you know, how they felt on a certain issue or person. And we've seen a couple of decisions in the last few years that have pretty much dismantled that substantial compliance issue and have somewhat limited access to the ballot in ways that we haven't seen before in Michigan. So I don't know what the implications for his campaign are kind of different from what the implications may be for voters in Michigan.
You know, your Free Press colleague Stephen Henderson noted the irony in the fact that it was convicted felon Tom Barrow, who himself was three times rejected as a mayoral candidate by voters, and he's the one who got Mike Duggan booted off the ballot.
That is true. You know, Tom is, as you notice, he's run several times. And, you know, I think that he really cares passionately about process. Mm-hmm. He went through months or maybe even a year of challenges to the 2009 election result. So, you know, I mean, I can't speak to his motivations in this, but my impression has always been that he's someone who's very invested in process.
Well, Mike Duggan, of course, was right up there at the top of the slate of candidates, along with Wayne County Sheriff Benny Napoleon, who clearly must be smiling over today's developments. But I'm wondering, Nancy Kaffer, how would you describe the mayoral field minus Mike Duggan?
I wish I knew. Now, it certainly upended the race. Obviously, Duggan and Napoleon were polling neck and neck, kind of trading out of the top spot in each new poll that would be released. Everyone else is polling dramatically lower. I mean, I think that those guys were up in the 30s mm-hmm. last poll I saw, and everyone else was under 10%, maybe under 5%. I mean, it was very low. So this obviously elevates someone who had been trailing considerably into the second spot. Now this is a very different situation. Many times after a primary, you'll see a leading candidate throw their support to another candidate who made it through the primary.
Right.
I don't know if we're going to see that here. There's not a natural alliance that I'm seeing between Duggan and an existing candidate. Certainly, we know I would say that we can imagine he's probably not going to be endorsing Tom Barrow. But other than that, you know, I mean, it's what will Duggan supporters do? Will they line up to vote for Napoleon? Will they choose another candidate? Will they decide to sit this one out? There's a lot of questions that we're going to learn the answers to in the next few months.
Detroit Free Press editorial writer Nancy Kaffer. Thanks so much, Nancy.
Thank you for having me.
We live in a complex world of technology, of instant communication with just about any spot in the world. It's fast-moving, and it's all too easy for us to lose track of our roots, our history, our sense of place. Just who were the first people to call Michigan home? Well, welcome Bill Lovis, and we're going to find out as we talk with him. He's a professor and curator of anthropology at Michigan State University. Good to have you with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Bill, how many thousands of years do we need to go back to pinpoint when the first people arrived in Michigan?
Well, anywhere between 11 and 12,000 years ago.
And where did they come from?
Well, seeing as how we were under ice before that, they came from the south.
Okay.
Which may sound like an overly simplistic answer, but not really, because Michigan was glaciated by several different so-called lobes of the last glaciation, and they receded variably to the north or the northeast and so forth, and really opened up southern Michigan first.
So they made their way. As the ice melted, they worked their way into Michigan then.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, as the ice receded and melted, there were varying early configurations of the Great Lakes. And they really didn't stabilize in what we would consider to be modern configurations until just a few thousand years ago.
So the lifestyle and the kind of Michigan that they would have known is very, very different from even what we think of it from colonial days.
Well, absolutely. Unless you've run across a mastodon recently, they would have been dealing with a very different environment.
Now, when we hear about European era back then, it was much about stone-tipped spears and making bone and antler tools. Was that much the same with these early Michiganians?
Well, absolutely. Until Europeans arrived here in the 1600s into the Western Great Lakes, the only metal that was being used was native copper. And that was largely something that was being hammered, you know, after being heated. It wasn't being melted and cast and turned into, you know, very complex kinds of things, but, you know, basic utilitarian things that mimicked some of the bone, antler, and stone tools.
When did they move beyond the hunting that these early settlers did into more farming and trading?
Well, and that's actually a question of degree. We know that they had domestic plants in Michigan, at least in southern Michigan, and particularly in the Saginaw Basin, as early as 4,000 years ago. So we know that they were at least familiar with these kinds of squashes and gourds. They become more prevalent by about 3,000 years ago, and we start to see the introduction of other domestic plants, indigenous domestic plants, coming in about that time. But agriculture itself really doesn't take hold in southern Michigan until probably 1,000 years ago or thereabouts. That's when we start to see the majority of the domestic plant foods, including the larger pieces of corn and corn cob and corn kernels showing up in the archaeological record. We do, however, just to put things in perspective, we do have what we call microbotanicals, that is evidence from things like plant starch or little silica bodies in the plant stems called phytoliths that go back over 2,000 years.
And what does that tell us?
That tells us that they had corn here, but it wasn't maybe being used the same way or as intensively. It probably wasn't a primary food crop. So it was probably being used in other ways. It may have been traded in. It may have been grown and used for ritual purposes, but we don't have a lot of evidence for corn use that early.
We're talking with Bill Lovis, who's a professor and curator of anthropology at Michigan State University, exploring the first people of Michigan, taking us back to really the very beginning of our history as people in Michigan. I'm interested, Bill, if you can give us a sense. When those first Michiganders made it here some 12,000 years ago, as those glaciers were receding, how close was Michigan's terrain to what we're used to today, or was it very different?
Actually, the glacial ice didn't leave Michigan completely, and by Michigan I'm including the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, really didn't leave until about 9,000 years ago. So what we had was, first of all, an environment that had ice on it until 9,000 years ago. So if southern Michigan was starting to get deglaciated as recently as 11,000 years ago, what we're looking at is Michigan with some ice, sometimes more, sometimes less, for at least 3,000 years.
And would the forest be heavy as it got deglaciated, or would that have taken time?
That would have taken some time because the glacial fronts were they're rough places to live. You know, they're still cold. They have high winds. As they expose new soils and landscapes, it takes a while for vegetation to establish itself. So, you know, they wouldn't have been heavily forested. So, you know, it takes several thousand years for that to actually happen. Although, you know, that said, there are a few patches of deciduous woodlands in the more southern parts of the state fairly early on.
Now, what kind of traces do we have of these early Indians, these Paleo Indians?
Well, first of all, congratulations on knowing that they are Paleo Indians. Most people don't even know that term.
Once an archaeology student, always an archaeology
student,
Phil.
Always an archaeology student, exactly. It comes in a variety of different forms. some of it is what we would call direct evidence, you know, very straightforward stuff like stone tools, which, you know, thank goodness, are not easily perishable, you know, so they preserve for extended periods of time. So we have, you know, spear tips, we have knives, we have scrapers, we have specialized tools that were used to groove bone, all sorts of things like that. We have what would be considered to be more indirect evidence, potentially things like cut marks on bone. And there is at least one of my colleagues at Ann Arbor who has specialized in looking at mastodon remains to see whether there are traces of Paleo-Indian manipulation of the bone, butchering and cutting and that kind of thing.
Any structures, any burial mounds that could trace back where you could say, yes, that's from those first Michiganders?
Nope. They were not, at least to our knowledge, they were not building mounds until quite a bit later in time. So the earliest inhabitants, no, we're not doing that. In fact, the way to think about this, and it's a little bit difficult for people who live in a modern society to do this, to think about a landscape that doesn't have any buildings, where you're basically you're living with your mother, your father, your children, maybe some grandparents, maybe a couple of families of you, and you are moving between the different resources by walking across a fairly wet, barren, cold place.
Take us up now to the 1600s when the first Europeans, which we understand to be the French fur traders, come to Michigan. We have certainly are well aware of the impact, mainly not for the good, that the Europeans had on the indigenous societies. What about the other way around? What impact did the indigenous Michiganders have on that budding European society in America?
Well, that's a very interesting question. If you think about the fact that corn and squash and other crops like that were all things that were grown in the Americas and not in Europe until the Europeans got here. Mm-hmm. They had a big impact on the foodways of the rest of the world. So, you know, very early on, for example, we find that things like drawings of North American squashes, paintings of North American squashes, show up in the Royal Herbariums and other areas like that in Europe. So they're actually bringing these crops over. And, of course, they also helped us with our smoking habit.
They did, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
When we think, Bill, of those early people, give us a sense, if you can, how, in essence, they still touch our lives today, or do they?
Well, anybody who has a corn cob, you know, with their brat in the summer is being impacted by Native American society right there.
It's a pretty good one. There's nothing like sweet Michigan corn around August,
That's
is there?
Exactly right. Although they didn't have sweet corn. It was a different variety. But you know, corn is a North American crop. Squashes were domesticated in Mesoamerica and made their way up into the Great Lakes, were transmitted up here and became a part of the economy up here. So, you know, these are the food crops are exceptionally important contributions to the world economy, not just European economy.
Well, it really is good to stop and think about the sense of context and perspective and who was here long, long, long before what we consider, you know, not too long ago. So the colonial era is really a very new compared to the ancient history in Michigan.
That's exactly right. And in fact, several months ago, I had an exhibit that one of my colleagues at the Smithsonian, Maria Raviel, and I put together with a science curator here, Julie Fick, and we titled it Michigan's First Farmers. And what it was designed to do was to present to the public the notion that it wasn't just Europeans coming over here and farming that was the first farming. that people were over here producing lots of different kinds of crops for 1,000 years or more before Europeans ever set foot in the Great Lakes.
Bill Lovis, professor and curator of anthropology at Michigan State University. Thanks for taking time to talk with us, Bill.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Still to come, the U.S. Farm Bill has passed the Senate, but the House wants more cuts to the federal food assistance program. We'll speak with Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee. We'll find out whether or not she's willing to bargain over cuts to SNAP, something almost 2 million Michiganders receive. That conversation is next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Its official title is the Senate Agriculture Reform Food and Jobs Act, but feel free to call it the 2013 Farm Bill. It was passed last week by the Senate on the wings of strong bipartisan support, a vote of 66 to 27. This nearly $1 trillion bill has been over a year and a half in the making. Not only does it slash $24 billion from agriculture programs, but it makes substantial changes in the way the federal government spends money on efforts like the Federal Food Assistance Program. We'll talk with the chairperson of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow. That comes up in a few minutes. But first, let's get a sense of just what's in the Senate Farm Bill. For that, we turn to David Schweikart. He's the professor of Michigan State University's Department of Agriculture, Food, and Resource Economics. Hello, David.
Thank you.
So even though the unofficial name is the Farm Bill, this act certainly goes way beyond just what or does or doesn't happen down on the farm. Can you explain how it impacts all of us, even those who never set foot on a farm?
Over history, the Farm Bill has evolved. And even though we keep that name, and it is a rather convenient name, it's also pretty misleading. Farm Bill includes everything from food stamp and other nutrition programs. The food stamp program has been renamed as SNAP, but it also includes childhood feeding programs, women, infants, and children programs for pregnant women and very young children. It includes things like conservation programs that farmers rely on to help protect the environment. There are actually on the order of 12 titles of the Farm Bill of different pieces of government programs that are provided by the Farm Bill, and they include everything from commodity program payments to farmers all the way over to issues in food safety and inspection and labeling. So it's very wide-ranging piece of legislation, and that's part of the reason why it has survived so long.
It has been a while to rewrite this Farm Bill. It's the first, if we can get the Senate and the House to pass it, it'll be the first time since 2008. And certainly the Senate version took a lot of massaging to get bipartisan support, which it has. Can you give us the key points of this 2013 version of the Senate's bill?
Sure. On the Senate side, there are two or three major aspects that I think would be of particular interest in Michigan. First, on the agricultural side, farm programs are revised in a manner that makes them more market-oriented than they have been in the past. Payments are based on losses of revenue, when farmers suffer losses of revenue, rather than the direct payments that we had before that were paid even during periods of relative prosperity.
Is that a good thing, by the way?
Well, if you look at the Farm Bill as one of the objectives of the Farm Bill as providing a safety net for farmers when perhaps prices are very low or when yields are low because of a drought or weather event, if that's part of what the purpose is, which is what we often say part of the purpose is, then you want to deliver the money when it's needed and not deliver the money when it's not needed.
All right.
And I think this constitutes a major step in that direction. So in that sense, you might refer to it as a good thing, I suppose.
Okay.
On the food nutrition side, the Farm Bill maintains more or less the existing level of food stamp spending. There is a $4 billion cut over 10 years, but that's relatively small out of a program that's costing in the range of $80 billion now. it continues some of those. It does focus, try to focus and help food stamp recipients purchase healthier foods and encourage connections between local farmers and SNAP recipients in terms of SNAP use at farmers markets. So there's a good deal there that's relevant to Michigan. And then finally, on the conservation side, the conservation programs are focused on a wider range of environmental issues, which when you have a state like Michigan that has a lot of different environmental conditions surrounded by water, et cetera, that's important in terms of protection of natural resources here in Michigan.
Looking ahead, what happens if Congress doesn't pass a bill before the extension on the existing bill? It goes back to 2008. What happens if a new one doesn't get passed?
Well, if we got into that situation, I think there'd be a lot of pressure to do the same thing that we did last year, which is offer another one-year extension. Last time we attached that extension to the fiscal cliff deal late in December, and so it went down to the very last moment. My guess is that whatever happens this year in both the House and in the conference, if they have to, they'll work until the very last moment of in December to try to get something done. And then I think everyone's least favorite outcome in this whole process would be another extension.
David Swihart, a professor in the Michigan State University Department of Agriculture, Food, and Resource Economics, giving us the overview of the 2013 Farm Bill. Thank you so much, David.
Okay, thank you.
As we just spoke about, the Farm Bill would cut funding to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, by more than $4 billion spread over the next 10 years. The House version of that bill includes $20 billion in cuts. Nationwide, more than 47 million people receive federal food assistance, and that's about nearly 2 million of them here in Michigan. Joining us now is the head of the Senate Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee, and really the champion of the Farm Bill, Michigan Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow. Senator, welcome back to Stateside.
It's always great to be with you.
A lot of the headlines related to this bill have to do with the SNAP program. So I want to talk about the 2 million people who get food stamps in Michigan. Critics are accusing the Senate of hurting those who depend on that safety net because it cuts $4 billion over 10 years. What's your response to that?
Well, the good news is that we were able in the Senate bill to have a strong bipartisan vote to make sure that everyone who's receiving help right now in Michigan, everyone who qualifies for what's called supplemental nutrition assistance, that's a SNAP, will continue to receive that. We have no cuts in the overall program in terms of those who qualify for help, and we don't change the qualifications for that other than to look at some areas where there has been fraud and abuse.
And what would those be?
That's where the savings be.
Where would you be looking?
There, first of all, we've had at least two folks in Michigan who won the lottery, got payouts, and continued to get food assistance. Obviously, that's wrong. We make that illegal. We go after some other areas where retailers have fraudulently given people cash for their nutrition card, and folks can go out and buy their things like drugs and so on.
So if someone legitimately qualifies for assistance now, you are saying this does not change anything and they would still continue to get their benefits as long as
Correct.
They meet all the requirements?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, we know that the House version of this bill, they're talking about cutting $20 billion. And I'm wondering, Senator, are you willing to make concessions if the House doesn't back down from that proposed $20 billion cut to SNAP? Where would you draw the line?
Well, I draw the line on saying that people who need help and qualify for the SNAP program should be receiving it. They shouldn't be penalized because they've fallen on hard times. Just as crop insurance is there if a farmer has a disaster, food assistance is there if a family has a disaster. And you hope you don't need it, but if, you know, hard times, bad weather, disasters, you need it. So it's the same thing. So the House bill is very extreme. It would eliminate 2 million people from getting help, getting any help. And it changes the way that it's structured. And I do not support that and will not support it. It's actually, but that type of proposal has been voted down three times in the Senate. Neither my Republican ranking member nor I support the kinds of cuts that we have in the House bill. So if we want to tackle fraud and abuse and tightening that up, I'm all for it. Hurting people who legitimately need some temporary help, that is not something that I will support.
And, Senator, knowing that the last farm bill that cleared both the House and Senate was in 2008, what does it mean to the nation if there's not a way to iron out these differences between the Senate and the House version and a bill doesn't get passed this year?
Well, I'm very optimistic we will get it passed, although the House, we passed the bill in the Senate last year. The House would not even take it up, which caused the regular bill to expire last year, and we cannot let that happen again. The good news is the House is now taking up a bill so we can resolve things in conference. But here's what happens if we don't get it done. First of all, we're paying out $5 billion a year in subsidies that go to farmers in good times that everybody has agreed we shouldn't be paying. Those will continue. If we don't get a farm bill done, we won't have the new and improved conservation title. We won't have the Great Lakes Initiative that's in conservation in the bill. If we don't get a farm bill, we won't see the support we need for our specialty crop growers, fruits and vegetable growers. We won't see increased support for local food systems and farmers markets. We won't see the efforts on tackling fraud and abuse in the food system that we've put in. There are so many things. And ultimately, the $24 billion in savings that we put to reducing the deficit, we won't have that.
And the timetable, what are you expecting to see as far as the time it might take the House to take up theirs and then to kind of align the two versions and get something passed? What's your hope?
Well, the good news is that I expect the House to pass a bill within the next 2 weeks. They are debating it right now. If they can pass it, which I hope they will, we will immediately do our best to get to a conference committee where we can work out the differences and make sure that this is done by September 30th. And I'm going to continue to push hard to accomplish that.
Michigan Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow, thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
So let's continue looking at the SNAP program and the possible cuts to it. Terry Stengel is the executive director of the Center for Civil Justice in Flint. She joins us now. Terry, we just heard Senator Stabenow tell us people who legitimately qualify for federal food assistance won't lose anything, and the Senate bill tightens loopholes and reduces fraud. Does that ring true from where you sit?
Well, I think there's another way of looking at it. What the Senate bill does is it does take away an option that is currently legal under the Farm Bill to give additional food assistance to people whose utilities are included in their rent. And that helps make up for the fact that they don't get normally a full utility allowance. And Michigan has used that option for a number of years to help people who often are on fixed income, who pay a flat amount, to get a little bit of extra food. So I personally don't see that as an abuse, but it would affect a much smaller group of people than the House version.
Yes, let's talk about that House version with $20 billion in cuts. What's your sense of what that would mean?
That would have a huge impact on Michigan because the people who would be cut in Michigan are generally working households who have difficulty buying food because they have high housing, utility, child care, and child support expenses. The SNAP program takes those expenses into account and recognizes that when a family pays for those things, they don't have money to spend on food. And what Michigan has done since 2000 is to allow people with a little higher income who are working to still get help with food when these expenses take up a large part of their income. So it would have a huge impact for many, many families whose wages have been cut, whose hours have been cut, but still have higher mortgages, still pay for child support, and still have to pay for child care when they go for work.
So it seems like it's a balancing act between addressing abuses or people who are gaming the system and still meeting the needs of the working poor.
Well, I actually think that the SNAP program nationally has done an excellent job in dealing with any and all allegations of abuse. And the error rates in the program are very, very small. So what what we're really looking at now is people saying this is a large program. We just need to cut more people off of it without really looking at who is being cut off. And the folks they're talking about cutting now are not people abusing. They're people who legitimately can't afford food because of high basic household expenses, very legitimate and verified expenses, and they're just not being enough, given an opportunity to get help anymore in states like Michigan. So this seems to be a very just a move to cut a program that has grown as our economy has struggled. It's done what it's supposed to do and help people who are struggling when they have less work and less earnings.
So from the fact you're kind of boots on the ground working with these people who truly, need this assistance, is the talk about benefits going to lottery winners or college students whose families don't qualify for food stamps or store owners who resell coupons, is that not as much of a problem as perhaps it's being painted to be?
Right. I don't think that's a significant problem. And there have been legislative changes at the state and federal level that would make it clear that those things cannot be done. So lots of efforts are already being done to address that. What we're looking at here is simply saying there's too many people and not abuse. This the cut that we're looking at right now in the House is we don't want people that are working that have high expenses to get this help. And that's precisely what the program should be doing. I mean, the most that a single person can get with absolutely no income on the SNAP program is $200. That's less than $5 a day for food. And most people in Michigan get about $4.50 per day per person. So it's still a very small amount, and it's combined with earnings. So this is not a bloated program where people are getting lots and lots of benefits. It's a very basic program to provide nutrition, which is a good investment in health, in child development, in just general well-being for families.
Terry Stengel, I'm interested in your thoughts. Last week, Congressman Dan Kildee and Congressman Sandra Levin did their food shopping within the constraints of that food stamp budget, about $31.50 for the week. Do you think these food stamp challenges legitimately help poor and struggling people?
Well, I think they help the general public have a better idea of what struggling families are having to do every week to feed their families. So I think they raise awareness that these programs are not bloated, that they really are very, very basic, and how difficult it can be to provide fresh food and nutritious food on $31 a week per person. So I think they raise awareness, and they also raise awareness on policymakers who are making the critical decisions. So in that way, I think they're helpful.
And what will you be watching for, Terry Stengel, as the House takes up its version of the Farm Bill?
Well, right now there are 200 amendments that have been proposed to that Farm Bill, and there are meetings now to see which ones are going to go for debate. So I really, really hope that the big $20 billion cut is taken out so it's closer to the Senate version. And I just understand that President Obama has threatened to veto the Farm Bill if it looks like the House version. So the stakes are very high.
Terry Stengel is Executive Director of the Center for Civil Justice. She joined us from their office in Flint. Terry, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We'd like to get your thoughts on the Farm Bill or anything else you heard on today's program. And we can connect with you and you with us very easily. Find us online at michiganradio.org. Look for the Stateside link. On Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.